From Acres USA, you're listening to Tractor Time, a conversational podcast where we'll explore sustainable farming, regenerative practices, and the latest innovations in eco-agriculture with some of your favorite farmers and ranchers. I'm your host, Sarah Wenzel-Fisher, the Executive Director of the Kavira Coalition. Welcome to Tractor Time. Today we're speaking with Joy and Eric McEwen. Joy manages Dig and Live and Farm and Apiaries, a homestead organic farm and commercial beekeeping operation. She holds two bachelor degrees of science, as well as a master's degree in environmental science from Oregon State University. When she isn't tending hives or farming, she works as an apitherapist with a practice in Southern Oregon and makes a line of June beverages called Honey Bee Brews. Joy is a committee member on the USDA Farm Service Agency Board for Josephine and Jackson Counties, Oregon, and serves as a board member on the Illinois Valley Watershed Council, as well as the American Apitherapy Society. Eric heads the beekeeping operation for Dig and Live and Farm and Apiaries. He holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Botany and Plant Pathology from Oregon State University. He spent the last 20 years experimenting with the development of organic management practices while tending approximately 700 honeybee colonies. A former mentor for the Oregon State University Master Beekeeper Program, Erica served as the Southern Oregon representative on the Oregon State Beekeepers Association Administrative Board. He's a member of the Adaptive Bee Breeders Alliance, a SARE-funded consortium of honeybee professionals and academics collaborating on stock improvement-focused breeding efforts. We'll talk about that during this episode. He is the originator and manufacturer of Natural Nest Beehives, an improved style of 8-frame Langstroth equipment for both organic and traditional beekeeping. Eric is also a trained botanist and naturalist who loves the wild side of the great outdoors. Welcome. Nice to see both of you. Thank you both for your patience in terms of getting this interview scheduled. I know that has been a long time in the making, and so really great to see your faces and actually get to have the opportunity to chat with you a little bit.
Yeah.
Likewise. Yeah. Thanks we're not always easy to pin down either.
Maybe we can just start with like an introduction. Who are you? Where are you? What are you up to?
Well, we are here at the farm right now. So we are at Dig and Live and Farm and Apiary in Tequilma, Oregon. So we're about just the very southwestern part of Oregon, about 20 miles to California and about an hour to the coast. We get about 65 inches of rain a year. And it's a beautiful, productive place for our honeybees. It's part of why we moved here. We're from, we spent a bunch of time in Corvallis. And then in the idea of wanting to be farmers and own land, where did we want to go? We wanted to go to Southern Oregon. And part of it was like this wildness factor, both in terms of land and people.
Yeah.
but wild rivers, clean air, clean water. That's where we are right now. It's a really beautiful place.
We moved to the Illinois Valley about 20 years ago. And we've been keeping bees only a few years longer than that. So most all of our commercial beekeeping experience, we really came down here and got a business started. So we've had the pleasure of keeping bees in some of the same locations for over 15 years and on our home property about 20. And it's been really awesome to watch the transformation of the sites where we keep bees, but also, to have been in one place this long really gave us the opportunity to get to know the landscape, get to know the good spots for keeping bees, get to know the seasonal rhythms, and really get our rhythm down as far as the timing of when we do our work with the bees in the spring and in the fall. And that feels really great to feel grounded like that, to have that pattern and to fall back on the reliability of that to some extent. And then, to be in this pristine spot, it really is a special place we live in. We have a lot of access to wild forage in all of our apiaries, access to native plant communities, riparian communities, as well as awesome productive organic farms. So it's a really nice place to be a beekeeper. And we also have the pleasure of not really having any other commercial operations operating around kind of the heart of where we do our work. And that affords us a big privilege in terms of the long-term breeding project that we're engaged in.
I will just also add to that. So we're in the Illinois River Valley, where the main town is Cave Junction, and I think it's about 2,000 people. And then the Illinois River Valley is about 17,000. So it's pretty rural.
Yeah.
And then also just like who we are is my background's mostly just like this goes way back. I mean, in like organic production, organic farming, and I have a master's degree in environmental science. And then Eric is mostly a botanist by trade. He spent a lot of time out in the woods.
Yeah.
And he's not very good at paperwork. So we brought him back.
I'm trained in non-vascular botany, but also did a lot of time studying genetics and population genetics. So it's actually been a pretty great educational background for beekeeping. I'm intimately associated with all the plant communities around here. And so I feel like the intuition of the timing of management and managing honey production ties into paying attention to the plants. And that comes a second nature to me. And then like thinking about my history in genetics has been rather helpful tools for moving forward into understanding the rather complicated reproductive biology of honeybees and the implication, the genetic population genetic implications of a very complicated mating system. So that has been helpful too.
Eric is an amazing naturalist. You can like walk through the woods with him and just kind of like as you're walking, he can tell you about like just what plants we're about to see based on how the hillside has changed and the water retention and where he can just read a landscape so beautifully. And then I guess my background I'm just more of like the efficiency kind of a girl. With organic farming, where we have to do systems approaches, where Eric does like landscape approaches.
I mean, it sounds like a great compliment and also makes me want to totally go on a hike with you sometime if I ever make it to that part of Oregon. So,
yeah.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Yeah, I'm wondering if we could dive a little bit deeper into two aspects. One is I'd love to hear a little bit more about your farm in particular, and sort of what are the different enterprises that you have there? It sounds like bee breeding is one of them, but reading your website was really fun to learn about bee medicine. And it sounds like you have some other enterprises on your farm. Do you want to just sort of talk about those structures a little bit? And like, sounds like beekeeping is at the center of it, but that even there are potentially overlapping enterprises. I'd love to just sort of hear, like, how does all of that work?
Well, I guess I'll just start by sharing that we are a family farm. We do farmers markets. We had a retail store for 9 years. Part of what any family farm is kind of looking towards, I mean, for us, it was about kind of being diversified. Mm-hmm. Like if you're going to the farmers market and you're just selling honey, it's great and what a showstopper, and we can just talk a whole bunch all about honey and our honey in particular, but for us to really get to share our whole farm approach is part of what makes us special and unique. And so we're always and that's part of our success too, is just kind of getting to, like, for one example is like we make a line of Jun. It's like kombucha, but made with honey instead of sugar. And in that case, it's like getting to have those samples, you know, getting to lure customers in to start talking to us about the farm.
Our fascination with bee products is certainly part of the story. And then the other part of the story is just wanting a beautiful display of products for sale, you know? So that's what really led us into candle making, was just sort of the intuitive awareness that if we're going to be beekeepers, we should be candle makers. And it turns out that making candles is really fun. So, you know, we can make a year supply of candles by just making candles 2 or 3 times a year for, you know, 3 to 6 days or something. We'll set up shop and we'll churn out a whole bunch of candles, and then that'll get us through several months, and then we'll do it again or something. So it's a nice little that's some of the fun of our enterprises, is that most everything that we make, we try to make products that have shelf stability, you know, so that we learned, you know, the hard way right away playing around with being produce farmers, that was a real challenge to get a product to market while it was still viable and, you know, marketable. And we thought to ourselves, you know, there's some real strong points to beekeeping in that regard, that honey really is good forever, and other products that we make are shelf stable. So the medicines that we make, for either being from a vinegar honey tincture or an alcohol tincture, those are great shelf stable products that last, you know, somewhere between 2 and many, many years. And then our candles, of course, are good that way too. So we get to kind of jump back and forth, and that's kind of fun. We can change with the seasons. A lot of our work is seasonal, you know, even all of the work we do with the bees is, it's so much of it changes depending on the time of the year. So we're always kind of like charting our coming weeks, and you never really feel like you're doing the same thing for very long. And I didn't mention gin making.
Well, we have so many different, I mean, we got our wood shop. We also, right. Just being part of growing plants and medicinal plants for the bees, like having a farmscape that is supporting the bees, and then being able to have those products that can then be part of the value-added scene. You know, it's just really trying to stack functions in that way, having things be dual purpose.
Yeah.
So even like things like making candles, we also enjoy drying flowers so that we can put them on the candles. You know, different things where we're always trying to stack functions.
Yeah.
That's great. It sounds like you also are collaborating with other farmers in your region in terms of where your bees are housed. Can you talk a little bit about, like, how does that work? How do you establish those relationships? What constitutes a good relationship with a neighboring farmer? And then I guess also, how does that contribute to a larger functional local food system and ecology?
Great question.
It's one of our favorite questions, really. We love it because we love working with the farmers we do. I mean, we do work with some of the best. So like Alexander Family Farm out in Crescent City, Stephanie and Blake Alexander. I mean, then we have Herb Farm.
Well, just hold on. It's like, just backing up. Alexander Farm's like 2,400 acre regenerative dairy and egg farm where the entirety of the farm is lush, dark green, full of flowers like clover, dandelion, plantain, just these fields that are just lush with productivity and abundance. And these animals, either cows being grazed by the thousands or chickens being grazed by the thousands in these movable coops that they move every 2.5 days across this huge landscape. Each one of these movable coops, I think, gets like 20 acres that it's moved on. And so it's just the par excellence of regenerative farm with ever abundant sources of wildflowers, all the ground, always in turnover and looking so good. It's such a pleasure to keep bees in a landscape like that, for starters.
And not only that, they're so inspirational. That's 5 generations, 5-generation family farm. And the Dig and Livin' kids and the Alexander Farm kids spend time together, and they invite our kids to spend the night and to just be part of the farm experience there.
Yeah.
So real relationships. And like, I feel like that one in particular, I remember when I first met Blake, I mean, this was like 10 years back, and we were both just like, oh, like we have the same interests. Let's work together.
Yeah.
And we've just gotten to build on that and in so many different respects. But I'll add to that, it's like Herb Farm, like the one and only, like the Herb Farm out in Williams, Pacific Botanicals. One of our very favorites is Oshala Farm. I mean, these are some of the best certified organic medicinal herb farms in the country. And well, Jeff and Elise of Oshala Farm, they've become dear friends of ours. We've really learned to rely on each other. I guess that's one thing that is both new and old about this relationship, farmers in general, is that like we, throughout time, we've relied on each other. And when one of us does well, the other one does well. When one of us doesn't do well, like we used to feel that. And by having these relationships, it's just like, it just makes all of us stronger. And there's so many different parts of it. It's just becoming such an important part of what we do.
As to your question about how to establish those relationships,
Yeah. That's
kind of one of the beautiful things about being a beekeeper is that you establish those relationships slowly over time. And that's kind of how beekeepers tend to be a little protective of the area that they operate in. And there's such a thing as there's a set of code, there's a mores and rules that beekeepers tend to adhere to in establishing sort of precedent in a given area. But it's also those word of mouth relationships that you have with your bee yards. And so that's how you acquire the space to operate is over time. And so you couldn't really just, it's not very easy to say, pick up a commercial beekeeping operation and move to a new location. You would almost have to go buy out another operation somewhere else and ask for introductions to the landowners in hopes of finding enough places to operate without stepping on a lot of toes in most parts of the country.
But also, just to get specific, is like when we do have those relationships, some of them are like if it was in the case of like pollination, like in those cases, we're getting paid to pollinate the crop. But in the cases where we have these relationships, we generally are giving them about a gallon of honey per yard. And we also are just like, we ask them ahead of time, like if they would like it as a gallon or sometimes it's like pounds so that they can give it to their employees and things like that. But usually they end up even, you know, buying more from us or whatever, you know.
When we tend to give more to our favorite yards.
Yeah. Or in some cases, like in Oshawa Farm, we have a few yards at that farm. So that increases what we give them.
Are you passionate about sustainable agriculture and gardening? Then visit the Acres USA bookstore today. They have the best selection of books on sustainable agriculture and gardening from leading authors like Elliot Coleman, Mark Shepard, Andre Liu, and others. Get 20% off any Acres book purchase today with the discount code ET20. Shop bookstore.acresusa.com and support sustainable agriculture. Is there any like specific story? I mean, you've mentioned a couple of them, but has there been anything sort of transformative with any of the farms that you're working with where being there and having your bees there is really overtly and obviously adding a layer to like soil health or the overall like ecological health of that particular place?
Yeah, for sure. I think where we really get to see this effect the most is in places that we've kept bees for a longer period of time. And if we have had the fortune, whether it be good or bad fortune, to put bees in a number of locations that sort of were kind of like waste ground or poorly, you know, ground that wasn't very productive. And seeing how fast ground like that can transform back into a place with topsoil and organic matter in the soil and a plant community that's thriving. You know, as somebody who plays with compost and organic fertilizers, you know, you can really see the difference in a plant community when it's not nutrient stressed or when the plants have enough nitrogen and what have you. You can see the effect on the plant community. And anywhere in proximity to a beehive looks like that. It's just dark green and rapid growth rates. And and so, you know, it's really easy to see it in the ring around a hive, right?
Or a ring around a pallet.
A ring around a group of hives. You'll see literally like a perfect ring of dark, lush growth from the nutrient deposition from the colonies right up close. But what's a little harder to see is that they're actually depositing feces and their bodies out across the whole landscape. So of course it's very easy to see right close, but when you start to see in these places where we're keeping bees year in year out on these places that are damaged and degraded, how fast the soil community recovers with that. And so we have a couple places where we keep bees in like fairly high density, and they happened to be places that aren't that were not very productive sites. They had been hayed or something for a really long time and lost all their topsoil, and now like are so thick after 10 years like that these that you could grow a commercial crop of hay on them again, you know. And so and then of course you see the bees for pollinating all of the flower species, and so you see this transformation in the plant community occur too. And so you see all this forage increasing on the landscape that wasn't previously there. It's really exciting.
We actually, we just got invited with, by SOU, Southern Oregon University, to start studying some of the effects of having our beehives on the landscape, both in terms of soil and fauna and flora.
That's super exciting. I love the way that Melanie Kirby talks about bees as livestock. My organization is more focused on ranching, but I think that there are a lot of parallels in terms of the relationships that beekeepers have with other farmers, and that whole soil health piece that you were just describing, where, you know, the soil health principle of integrating livestock may mean cows or goats or sheep, but it may also mean bees. So that's pretty neat to hear about. I want to talk about the bee breeding work that you're doing. But before we do that, I want to talk about your book. Can you talk a little bit about, I want to make sure I get the title correct, Raising Resilient Bees. What is it? What inspired it? And what are the main things that you want people to know about this book?
So yes, that's a question we get asked, of course. What does raising resilient bees mean to us? And to us, it means you know, tending to bees in such a way that enhances their own survival characteristics, their own thriving characteristics, you know, caring for bees in such a way that helps them to help themselves, and like teaching bees through a minimalist intervention, helping bees move on towards reacquiring the characteristics that they need to survive without so much help from people is certainly a goal for us. But also just raising animals with a high level of vitality, you know, and making sure that you're providing an appropriate environment for the vitality of the organism to come through in a way that you're not hampering it, you know. So of course, that means, you know, placing your bees in a pristine environment, hiving your bees in clean materials that aren't leading to residues in the food food and medicine that we're producing, but also not residues that are going to lead to an impairment on the immune system of the bees or something. So clean forage, of course, being really important there as well. Like the bees need access to good food. And so raising them in a way that they access clean forage and can find the medicines that they need to stay healthy. And then of course, what the title's really getting at is raising bees in a fashion that's going to contribute to an increased amount of resistance to varroa mites. And that's sort of like, that was kind of the lifelong goal that compelled, that was one of the big things that compelled us to keep bees on the scale that we do, was just sort of recognizing that there was other ways that we could address varroa resistance maybe than the mainstream methods being used out there in the world. So we felt like we had something to contribute to the way in which we assist bees in that, with that problem.
Can you talk about, just for folks who may not be familiar, like what is the difference between the way that you approach varroa resistance and the way that varroa is treated in other types of beekeeping?
First of all, I'll just give a tiny little bit of background. The beekeeping industry in general is using a technique called grafting, where a human transfers an egg from the comb of a honeybee colony into a little vessel that mimics the cells that queens are raised in. We call them a queen cup. So you're transferring an egg into a queen cup, and then placing that queen cup into a queenless colony. And thereby it stimulates the queenless colony to rear a queen in that vessel. And so that process is used to rear queens sort of at the backbone of the entire industry. All of the new colonies generated every year for sale for hobbyists to get started with, for instance, are all dependent on that process. And most all of the queens produced commercially that commercial beekeepers use for starting new colonies or for requeening existing colonies come from that process. So then understanding that, it's the response to varroa mite around the world has sort of been to turn to population of bees, wherever they may be, and look in that population for bees that have certain characteristics shown to diminish the reproductive capability of the mite. And there's various mechanisms in the bees that have been studied and discovered that help the bee kind of mitigate the mite population. And the standard practice to do is then finding a colony that expresses those traits in a really strong way. I would then graft daughter queens from the mother queen of that colony, thereby essentially cloning her matrilineal genes and then making a bunch of daughters of her, hoping that I could stabilize that trait in the population. The reality is most of those traits are recessive, and queens, our bees, are prodigious outcrossers. So when a queen flies forth into nature, she'll mate with about 15 males, usually not of relation to her. So then you get this big mixing of the genetics. And so it's very, very difficult to stabilize those behavioral traits that we're talking about. And so people use, they go a step further from grafting and they use what's called instrumental or artificial insemination, where they can take semen from known drones that are of relation to that high performing colony, presumably, and then inseminate a queen, thereby increasing the rate of homozygous recessive traits so that you could stabilize that trait. So that got a little detailed, but basically that's how it's being addressed. And what we are proposing is that while that's a powerful tool for finding and stabilizing useful traits, it has the unintended consequence of massively genetic bottlenecking. It's reducing the allelic diversity of your populations in a pretty dramatic way. And what we feel is that that might be unwise, and that the background genetic diversity of the feral populations and the managed colonies as well are probably holding the genetic diversity that is required for the next problem that's coming around the corner. And that if we go overtly and seek these traits and clone them, that we could be setting ourselves up for future problems. So what we set out to do that feels different is that we forewent the use of grafting and stopped accepting any new grafted material into our operation about 8 years ago. Well, we're coming on 8 years. This is our eighth season. And only rearing colonies from within our own operation. And then to take it a step further, we rear new colonies from every living colony in our operation every year. And so on top of that, we're raising more or less colonies dependent upon only one criteria, which is just the vigor of the colony. So we're trying to leave out any of these sort of artificial selection criteria and just select for productive, healthy colonies that are living in a healthy state with a minimum amount of intervention. And so then we're also just trying to not prop them up too much. So we're not using too much acaricides, and we're not using antibiotics, and we're not feeding, and we're doing things to try and really help the bees settle out who's the most productive in the operation. And then we, each colony will get somewhere between one and five or six new daughter colonies made from it each year. And thereby we're hoping that what will happen over time, and we're starting to see the signs of it at eight seasons, is that we're developing an inbred line where all of the bees are essentially slowly becoming related to each other, but we're also trying to be in an interplay with nature and maintain a suitable population that has within it a storehouse of genetic diversity. How's that?
That's fantastic. And I'll just say, I think that this audience loves that level of detail. So that's, thank you for sharing. Cool. That's fantastic. I want to get to the adaptive bee breeding network. I'm curious in terms of your approach to resilient beekeeping. Melanie is the person who I know who does similar work. She's thinking about genetics in terms of where wild bee populations may be bringing new genetics into her hives. Is that happening in your space as well? You know, you talk about this sort of being a closed system of genetics, but I wonder if you're in places that have a lot of wildness and have other types of bees there, how is that impacting that genetic resilience?
Great question. And so the short answer is yes, right? We're in a place with a nice, robust feral population. Mm-hmm. And we expect that we're in an interplay with that population because like we were saying, of course, we have a large influence on the breeding that's occurring in our queens. No doubt they're breeding with drones from our operation to a significant extent, but certainly it could be just as many certainly many feral contributions are occurring in all the time. So that's kind of the nice thing about A, being isolated, B, being in a pretty nice place for bees. There's a lot of habitat for bees in this valley. There's a lot of forest. There's a lot of ground that's not managed. And so because of that, we're probably in a pretty nice interplay network with our feral population. And so that's kind of the idea, is that what we would love to know is, because, you know, every beekeeper is in an interplay with nature to some extent. So you're either sort of part of a long-term solution or you're part of a problem, because you can't negate the interplay. So what are you doing to the local population? Are you, you know, swamping it out with one set of genes, or are you, you know, trying to maintain diversity? And then are you, you know, using the gentle hand of artificial selection, just good observation over time, essentially, to help have a positive influence on the traits that move into the feral population?
Let's talk about the adaptive bee breeding network, because I think that they're related. Can you say what it is, how you got involved, and what you are hoping to do or accomplish by participating in that network?
I think we all have a common goal of learning together, you know, learning more about what is a quality queen, what are the characteristics of a good colony, how can we share germplasm between each other to help each other in those goals. And for us, though, it's also just like about being part of a group and making sure that we can be out there tapping into the available tools and information that's coming forth from academia and from government research programs, and tapping into some of the resources to do our work. So, you know, we're getting access to genetic, helping cover the cost of genetic testing and things like that. So, it's going to open doors to us in terms of improving what we can do, what we can afford to do, and learning from others about different techniques. Like there's a plan that some of us are going to learn instrumental insemination. That's probably not something that's big on our plate, but we're also going to start mapping out our drone congregation areas in the areas where we do our breeding work, so that we can understand better, about things like you're talking about, the influence. Like if we knew, for instance, if we mapped out our drone congregation areas, then those are essentially the sites where queen breeding, queen mating takes place. And then you would get to really have an understanding of maybe a little bit more about the contributors to it. But ultimately, that'll be kind of the stuff we look into with genetic work. So ABBA, the Adaptive Bee Breeders Alliance, is going to, I think, just be a really great place where we kind of get to collaborate and say, like, what do we want to learn about?
Yeah.
Another topic that's come up is queen longevity. So we're starting to talk about projects where we could start looking into studying queen longevity. It's a subject that has sort of gotten swept aside in modern beekeeping.
And then I guess for me, it's also just really getting to meet and know some of these like wonderful beekeepers that we didn't. I mean, we've been pretty isolated out here in just rural southwestern Oregon. And Melanie just helped us all kind of network and get to know each other. It's kind of just bringing in that human element to both kind of inspire each other, learn from each other, and actually have fun with each other. Yeah.
Melanie's really good at finding people who think outside the box, creative people. And I think she's also got a penchant for helping younger people and people who are fresh into the industry, and giving people a leg up on their work. And so I think, honestly, we're some of the older members, but it's really great to be part of a group that is inspired and forward thinking.
That is part of it. I mean, for a long time when we got started here in Oregon, going to bee clubs and such, most beekeepers are over about 70, and so, or at the clubs, so to speak. And I know one of the things that Sam Comfort, who's part of the group, that he likes to say is like, the bees are doing okay. Really, we have to worry about, we're kind of like, we have endangered beekeepers at this point. We need to like bring in more younger beekeepers.
Yeah.
It's a great group.
Are you looking for the next bestseller for your favorite farmer or gardener? Visit the Acres USA bookstore to find the perfect gift for any loved one who likes getting their hands dirty. Find titles from great authors and farmers like Elliot Coleman, Mark Shepard, Andre Liu, and others. Get 20% off any Acres bookstore purchase with the discount code TT20. If there's somebody who is already beekeeping but wants to begin to experiment with your particular style of beekeeping, or who is brand new to beekeeping, you know, what are things that they could take away from your book, or what are like critical things that they need to be thinking about as they're taking steps to begin that journey?
Well, our book I was going to share is it has just quite a bit just about our story. People have described it as a manifesto. And so one of the things we really tell our story about is our type of beekeeping, which we've called natural nest beekeeping. So I think if we have beekeepers who are just wanting to start to get into the trade, what are the things that they will learn from the book? Some of the main tenets would be like how to get started. And one of the first ones is that we espouse in our book is using sustainable materials. So we're all about just wood and wax. So not using any of those plastic frames. And that's a big part of what we do. And also just like, where is that wood even coming from? So we look at the whole system and what is organic, what is biodynamic, and part of it is like the home itself and what is it made of? So that being one thing, and so that's definitely a part of when they get started, is to be thinking about if they want to learn from our book and be part of about naturalness beekeeping, and they like the style that we're talking about, it is thinking about where that material is coming from. And then kind of we go dive into really the inside of the hive too. So having the bees over winter, and also just the brood itself being of uninterrupted combs. So in the book, we talk about either like a three-sided frame or a four-sided frame, but essentially we're talking about, and this is also part of just biodynamics, is letting the bees draw out their comb uninterrupted. And then something a little different is to nadir. So we put an empty box underneath so then the bees can continue to draw out their comb. And then we're really into honey. So then it would be to super on top. Like we do a lot of what we're doing because we're really into being food producers and we're into just like producing some of the highest vibe food around. And so producing honey is a big part and why we're doing it. feeding our family like this amazing food. Yeah. Keep going. Yeah.
I just want to say, and just thinking about that person out there who's considering the book and the type of person who would do well with it. I think the book is really written for backyard beekeepers. It's written for backyard beekeepers. It's espousing a method of keeping bees that's easy, you know, that's not going to burden you with too much extra, so much equipment. Like it's streamlined. It's a system that's designed to cut costs and cut waste, but it's also a system designed to empower the backyard beekeeper. That's something that's kind of been missing in backyard beekeeping, is that the backyard beekeeper sort of is this like perpetual consumer in a lot of ways, not in every case, but
it's like bye-bye.
Yeah. They sort of end up in the situation where they're buying bees or they're buying queens. And this book is encouraging beekeepers to take on an extra set of tools to handle all that themselves in their backyard. And it's kind of espousing a method that's actually surprisingly simple, that a beekeeper could then sort of become self-reliant and be able to have everything they need in their backyard apiary to keep their colonies going year in, year out without having to sort of start from scratch all the time. And so what the book is good for is it somebody who's just getting into the business and into the hobby, because a lot of times once we make these initial equipment decisions, styles of boxes and what have you, it sort of tends to be a rabbit hole you go down, and it's not fun to change equipment styles. We've changed equipment styles twice.
A lot. You can see.
And it was
empty boxes all over for bookshelves and dressers and cookware. We just use all of our old equipment as organizers.
It's painful. So, I mean, I definitely would love to encourage anybody thinking about the hobby to read the book and consider what we're proposing before they buy equipment. And then even, yeah, like Joy was saying, like they could then, there's plans in the book. They could even take on the extra step of maybe even making their own equipment. And that's what we're proposing well. But it doesn't have this, certainly this style of keeping bees can be accomplished by purchasing equipment from catalogs and what have you. And you could do this style of beekeeping equipment, beekeeping without building any of your own equipment. And so,
well, definitely. And there's different ways out there to, like, one of the things in particular is using cedar for the boxes itself. But I think also not just for beekeepers that are just getting started, but beekeepers that have tried and true and that they've struggled and certain things about it doesn't work. I mean, one of the easy ones is just like pine equipment that's just really heavy and it's waterlogged. The bees don't like humidity. So like there's also beekeepers out there that are also just like, you know what, I'm this doesn't quite drive for me. I want to make decisions that are about sustainability and that feel good. And so all of those folks might be ready to be thinking about, how do I do this that feels in line with my values
and my body? Like, for instance, sort of the standard equipment out there that's promoted is really equipment that's really well suited to commercial beekeeping, but it's not necessarily that well suited. A 10 frame deep box full of honey can weigh over 80 pounds, maybe up to 100 pounds. And so all of a sudden, you know, you're just inflicting spinal compression on yourself to engage in this hobby. And a lot of people get into a state physically where they can't actually tend bees in that kind of equipment. So, you know, that's the upside of what we do. Our style is a little bit more equipment intensive because we're using smaller boxes. So you're going to need more of them, but the versatility that comes from that and the ease that comes from that, we can work our colonies all day long and walk away feeling good. And that for us is invaluable. So.
And our equipment comes with, you know, lots of tricks too. So generally it's like 8 frames, mediums, and then we have a divider board down the middle. We have 2 different entrances. All these things are tricks that we've learned that the bees really appreciate.
Some bells and whistles that play into our management style that you can learn about in the book.
Good for the bee and good for the beekeeper.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I would love to ask you, this is a question I'm asking everybody on this podcast, is in your perspective, what is the ecological role of the farmer?
What popped into my mind first is just looking at farming and what's required for farming and food production on the landscape. You know, it's certainly one of, if not the largest consumers of resources, and, you know, one of the biggest components of our land base. So farming has a huge, like, moral obligation to operate within some ecological balance, I feel like. And in these times today where we are gaining awareness about human effect on climate, human effect on the landscape, it seems like farming is one of the most exciting places where if we could resolve the nutrient cycling issue and the resource consumption issues associated with farming, we could really go a long way towards fixing the impact that humans have on the earth. So to me, there's just this huge opportunity for farmers to step into a role of ecological leadership. And of course, farmers probably shouldn't have to burden that alone. Our society should be stepping in and looking for opportunities to help farmers take that on. But I guess I just feel like, especially as a beekeeper, seeing bees and the interplay that they are in nature, the role they play in nature, then it seems like the only way to be a good beekeeper would be a beekeeper that's working to promote, you know, ecological integrity and promote the functionality of our ecosystems and diversity and richness, things like that. So fortunately, I kind of think that's what bees do. And so it feels kind of fun. It's kind of a pleasure to be a beekeeper in that sense, is that you feel like when you're managing your bees in an ethical way, that you're contributing in a very positive way to the carrying capacity of the land, to carbon fixation, soil production, fruit and seed set for the consumption by wildlife. Like, we feed all the birds, we feed all the bears, you know, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Do you want to throw in on that?
No, you nailed it. That was awesome.
That's great. Thank you so much. I think finally, is there anything that we didn't talk about that you would like to share with this audience?
Eat more honey.
That's great. I love that.
One of the byproducts of digging so deep and learning all these years about bees and bee products is that we really have gotten to dive deep on what is honey. And I think there's just a very, very big disconnect in our society about what honey actually is. And it's sort of relegated to being a sweetener. And that's just really a really sad misconception. Honey is so much more than a sweetener. It's actually a really, really good food supply for your body. Your body runs really well on the energy from honey. It does not inflict nearly the same kind of spikes in your blood sugar as most other sweeteners. Furthermore, it promotes good digestion. There is things in honey that help you in the digestion of other carbohydrates. All of the vitamins and minerals that are in honey are already in a dissolved state, so they're completely assimilable. So while they maybe don't look that much on the RDA or whatever, it all goes straight into your blood and travels very far in your body. Furthermore, there are enzymes in honey that oxygenate our bodies. And that is something that people aren't thinking that much about. But, you know, a lot of disease exists in an anaerobic state. And when the body is properly oxygenated, I argue that it is more healthy. So that's just the tip of the iceberg, right?
Yeah, we can keep going about honey. I mean, I think another part is just the low carbon footprint.
Yeah.
Like, when we talk about what foods and how far they're coming from, and especially how dense of a nutrient food that it actually is, And just the networking ability that the honeybee does, and all of that goes into the honey itself. But the low carbon footprint.
Yeah, I want to back up to the politics of honey. If we compare it to the other sweeteners out there, right? Like sugar is produced in capitalistic systems that create like inhumane working conditions and inappropriate wages, and you know, is exported for people, and yeah, and then is highly processed. Maple syrup is burnt. You know, agave nectar is a GMO corrupt product, like, and likely coming from a corrupt industry, but who knows? But like, it's just sort of like, what are you going to compare it with? You know, rice syrup or something? I mean, anyway.
Well, and it's just a vitamin. You can both take it just like internally and then topically. We do a lot of honey masks, honey facials, the cupping effect of honey, the burn. Actually, honey being used right now in just like wound therapy, actually surgeries, as a byproduct. Honey produces a small amount of hydrogen peroxide with this hydrophobic and hydrophilic layer. It just like makes it this like perfect insulative healer for just deep wounds. Yeah.
Yeah.
Eat more honey.
Eat more honey. I'm totally sold.
If we want to have North American honeybees, we need to have North American beekeepers.
Yeah.
Support your local beekeeper.
There we go. That was the next part.
Yeah.
Eat more honey and know your beekeeper. You know, make sure, because adulteration of honey is a big problem in the industry. One of the things that's crippling the beekeeping industry today is the foreign importation of fake honeys. And they are flooding into this country and they're ending up in all the places you can buy cheap honey. So don't buy your honey from the grocery store. If it's in a grocery store, make sure that it's a label that says your hometown on it.
And what would be great is if it was crystallized. Like, you're not looking for the liquefied honey. That means it's been heated. I mean, unless it's perfectly in season. But generally, if you get to see that honey that's from your town, your region, and that it's crystallized, then you know it's real honey. It has all the enzymes. Everything is intact. It's medicinal quality.
That's beautiful. Know your beekeeper. Eat more honey.
Yeah.
I like it. Yeah. I like it. How can our listeners find you?
Well, the best way is via our website, so www.digandlivin.com, and we've been working on that to just have all sorts of things for folks to be able to read and learn about us and ways to connect with us. We're going to start doing, like, we have both a way to connect with us for apitherapy, but also education, buying nukes, beehives, honey, and a little bit of candles.
Or just having a question. We tend to get emails from readers and other people just wanting to ask a question, and we do a pretty good job of getting back to everybody. So reach out that way. Mm-hmm. You can find us at farmers markets in the Rogue Valley in season, and you can reach out to us if you're in the region. And
of course, there's Facebook and Instagram and things like that.
Are you on social media, and what's your handle there?
Dig and Livin, and Dig and Livin Bees, Bees Here and Now. Actually, we have the handle Air B and B.
I saw that. I thought that was very cute.
Did you look at the Hive Hut?
I did not look at them yet. I just saw that you had that Instagram handle, and I thought that was amazing. So
it's real
I'm
sweet.
Into a good pun.
Oh, good. Yeah. It's like a sleeping chamber, and we have beehive air going into the chamber. It's really, really great for all sorts of respiratory illnesses. It's also a great way to just come on out to the farm and spend some time with us. So.
That sounds great. I definitely, when I come to take the hike with you all, I would love to come and stay. Thank you all for joining me. I really look forward to you digging into the book. I'm going to send it to my dad. Find Eric and Joy at digandlivin.com. It's a website that is rich in resources. I really enjoyed reading your website. Thank you both for joining me.
That was wonderful.
Yeah. My thank pleasure. You so much, Sarah. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Tractor Time, a podcast production of Acres USA. Find us on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, and other popular podcast platforms. Find other Acres USA media and learn about Acres events at acresusa.com. We'd like to thank Acres USA staff for their contributions to producing this podcast. This episode was edited and engineered by Brad Parsons of Train Sound Studio. And we're grateful to our guests for taking the time to talk with us about their experiences.